Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for coming to the Westminster launch of Better Off Out campaign, Save Britain's Cash campaign. This is the second campaign that we've launched this year, and it is run by the Better Off Out campaign. We're having a Westminster launch here, then elsewhere in the country, because it's about winning this referendum on June the 23rd, and we are looking to put a positive case for why Britain can manage its own affairs in the world. My name is Rory Broomfield. I'm director of the Better Off Out campaign, as well as the Freedom Association. I see many familiar and friendly faces in the audience from the Freedom Association. If, however, you haven't heard of the Freedom Association, we are a pressure group who believe in the principles of a free society, including individual freedom, limited government, the rule of law, and national parliamentary democracy, hence why we are against the European Union and UK's membership of it. Today we're talking about Britain's cash flow and saving it, and I'm more than delighted to introduce our campaign's manager, Rupert Matthews, to talk more about the campaign and what we're doing, as well as the investor and economist, Jonathan Davis, and the economist and commentator, Ruth Lee. They all have 10 minutes to talk about saving Britain's cash, but I may just leave you with this old adage that many people say that money talks, but in our opinion, when it comes to the European Union and the UK's membership of it, that money always seems to say goodbye. On that note, Rupert, over to you.
Thank you, Rory. Yes, good morning, everybody. As Rory has said, I'm the National Campaign Manager, so it's my business working with Lottie over there, who is today being our cameraman, to make sure that people out in the country have got the tools that they need to take the Brexit campaign out of the people of this country and convince them that Britain's future outside of the European Union is better than our future inside the European Union. Now, over the past months, we focused on various different aspects of our relationship with the European Union and how Britain could prosper outside of it. We've done various things. This time, as Rory says, we're focusing on cash, on money. And there are really two aspects to that. First of all, there is the direct cost to the British government, and this is what people tend to think of when they're talking about the cost of the European Union, and that's where this leaflet comes in. This leaflet is talking very much about the cost of the British Exchequer. So this is money that the British taxpayer sends across the water to Brussels for Brussels to waste and squander and get rid of in corruption. I'm sure, as you're all aware, the European Union accounts haven't been signed off by their own auditors for now 21 years. I can see Ray Finch lurking at the back, who knows his better than ours. 21 years, isn't it, Ray?
Give or take, who cares anymore?
And it's a colossal amount of money. It's been worked out that it's about £933 for each British family per year is taken up in those direct costs. There are also, of course, indirect costs to Britain of being a member of the European Union. This may be in terms of additional costs to our shopping bills every time we go shopping, because the European Union puts very high tariffs on some imported foods, but not on others. New Zealand lamb, for instance, gets clawed well and truly, whereas American wheat doesn't. And there's no real rhyme or reason to this. It just seems to be if it's something that can protect Greek olive growers or Spanish shepherds, there's a high tariff on it. If it's something that isn't going to be of advantage to European farmers, there isn't. But what that means is that every single one of us is paying more for our food inside the European Union than out. Then there is, of course, the cost of regulations, which can drive companies out of business. Of course, the big multinationals are okay there. Not only do they have lots of lawyers who can advise them on how to get around the regulations, but they've also got lots of lobbyists in Brussels making sure the regulations that they want and which suit big multinational corporations and put people out of work. And so we're also concentrating on that. This little leaflet, just a little two-sider, for instance, looks at the ways in which fish and chip shops are disadvantaged under European Union regulations. and that has led to a decline in the number of fish and chip shops. We've had quite a lot of success actually getting these put onto the counters in fish and chip shops. So when people are queuing up to buy their haddock and chips, they get a little bit of Brexit propaganda and information while they're doing it. We don't just concentrate on, if you like, you know, more populist stuff with leaflets and beer mats and so on, which we do. We also put out briefing papers on the different subjects. This is on Britain's cash. I think it runs to 8 pages. I think the one we did on the fishing industry ran to 12, but they do vary. But they include the hard facts and figures, all of which have been properly sourced so that we know that we are dealing with real facts and figures and not some of the stuff that you've been seeing the government just pluck figures out of the air over the past few days. And when they're challenged on it, they can't actually back them up at all. That's not a route we want to go down. And so there's been quite a lot of research going into these things. We also produce a range of other things. So we've got postcards, like say beer mats and such like. And it's our job to make sure that anybody who wants to campaign for Brexit has got the stuff they need to do so, and that all the facts and figures that we use are properly referenced and are properly sourced and are actual genuine facts and figures. So that if you're challenged, you don't have any qualms about, I'm not quite sure about that. It's all absolutely genuine, okay? I've got my business card here, which you can take later if you want to come up and talk to me afterwards, that's fine. But basically, anything that you want, whether you're doing door-to-door deliveries, whether you are having a street store, or whether you just want to have information so that you can talk to your friends and family about this, come and see me afterwards and I'll be absolutely delighted to help you with anything that you need. Okay?
Right, well, thank you very much, Rupert. Over to you, Jonathan.
Hello. Je voudrais commencer avec... J'adore l'Europe. Je déteste l'Union Européenne. As much as it remains a mystery to me that socialism and cronyism are still seen as the solutions by most, even though obviously nowhere and at any time in history have they actually worked. The EU is seen as a solution by the majority, even though for the people of the UK, for all SMEs, small and medium-sized enterprises, and for the decades that we've been a member, it's been an abject failure. Of course, some have benefited greatly. Multinational company executives, politicians, academics, farmers, diplomats, Sir Humphrey bureaucrats, lobbyists. So that makes up perhaps maybe up to 5% of the population. But the other 95% have paid for the 5% to benefit. And guess what? That is almost a definition for socialism or cronyism. You may recall another fine quote: the problem with socialism is you eventually run out of other people's money. And sure enough, they have. So they now borrow vast sums from the likes of the UK and Germany to bail out those who loaned to failed states when they should never have loaned the vast sums in the first place. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I call my next witnesses, the Royal Bank of Scotland and the People's Republic of Greece. The EU started as a coal and steel cartel, which OPEC then copied in the 60s and 70s until recently, and then became cuddlier as an emu. Not Rod Hull and Emu, by the way. Monetary union sounds positively charmant. It is now wholly political and pro the elite, continental farmers, largely, and their fishermen, and big businesses and big banks, all to the detriment of the people and SMEs. So you may ask, why does big business love the EU? And why does the EU hate SMEs? Let me start by telling you an EU joke. A free market capitalist Euro bureaucrat walks into a bar. No, of course you're right, there's no such thing as a Euro bureaucrat walking anywhere. They're transported everywhere in private jets and Mercedes limousines. the thought it would be Jaguar limousines. And that is the problem. Unelected bureaucrats who earn vast tax-free salaries, sorry, are paid vast tax-free salaries, they hardly earn them, and huge index-linked final salary pensions, massive expense accounts, have absolutely no idea what it is like for normal folk just trying to make their way. While in those positions, they live like billionaires, with huge numbers of flunkies at their beck and call, and like billionaires, they pay little or no tax. That is one reason why multinationals love the EU. Ask all the CEOs who base their EU headquarters in Luxembourg and pay little or no tax. Merci beaucoup, Monsieur Juncker. And these Eurocrats rarely, if ever, speak to real people. They meet with other Sir Humphreys, Herr Jobsperts, every day, politicians, lobbyists, and multinational executives. So of course, their thinking is based on those discussions and influences. But they have practically no discussions with real people running real SMEs. So big biz and big banks love the EU because they have access and they get to assist in rules drafting for which SMEs haven't a look in. That is one reason why big biz loves the EU. Another is the taxation. Yet another is the fact that the EU helps big biz actually crowd out the SME competition. In free markets, the little guy has a chance. In heavily regulated, cronyist or socialist markets, they have as much chance as finding Elvis alive on Alpha Centauri when we finally get there in the 23rd century on the real USS Enterprise. The Lord's Prayer has 66 words, the Ten Commandments 179, the Gettysburg Address 286, and EU regulations on the sale of cabbages amount to 26,911 words. Does this help a little business person with 101 things to deal with? Or the multinational CEOs who have senior executives at to head armies of departments dealing with regulations? I run a small firm of chartered financial planners, wealth managers. Now, it is arguably more important to ensure clean activities in my field compared to cabbages, no pejorative intended to cabbage sellers. And you may know of the massive expansion of financial services regulation since the 1990s. The Financial Services Authority messed up. Massive bank scandals, LIBOR, mis-selling, credit default swaps, HSB tax evasion work, money laundering for Mexican drug cartels. When HSBC threatened to leave Canary Wharf for Frankfurt or Hong Kong, unless they were allowed to pay less tax, I had to laugh. And I said often, it's like the unicorn, I'll believe it when I see it. Now it's no longer the Financial Services Authority, it's the entirely different, radically altered Financial Conduct Authority. Has anyone seen Life of Brian? Yes. The PFJ or the JPF? Same bureaucrats with massive salaries and index-linked pensions. Does it remind you of any other huge bureaucratic organisation about 700 miles east of here? The regulations which come out of the FCA originate largely from Brussels. However, the FCA and the EU have created absolutely enormous requirements way beyond reason. And think on this. The bank's CEOs hardly concern themselves with compliance. And why would they? Apart from the fact that they're crooks. Because they have vast resources of people and money to throw at the problem. In order to comply, it's a drop in the ocean for them. Whereas for my firm, and firms like mine, I can't tell you how much time, effort, and money I and my colleagues have to spend to meet these obtuse unnecessary and wholly unproductive regulations, which, you guessed it, are largely useless in actually achieving the objective of protecting those who use our services. So why are there so many regulations? Because the EU is in bed with big banking, and big banking would love to get rid of smaller competition. Remember the quaint idea of too big to fail? Well, there are now fewer big banks, and they are even bigger than they were. Would anyone bail out a small firm if it went bust? Would it help? But they'll take the billio from you and me and from our kids and bail out the global banks. Again, big corporations versus the little guy. The EU socialists and cronyists are scuppering SME plans every which way. Now, I'd love to tell you about TTIP, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, but I can't. No one can. It's been drafted by multinational corporations and accepted by the US elite and the EU elite, but no one can tell you what's in it as they're sworn to secrecy. It's of course not been published. If a politician wants to read it, he has to go into a room on their own, no recording equipment and no notepaper. So why the secrecy? Because it's fascism incarnate. The increasing merger of the corporation and the state, grazie signor Mussolini, and it will benefit the elite to the detriment of the people and SMEs. There are around 5.5 million businesses in the UK, of which around just 800 large companies are on the UK stock exchanges. Over 99% of UK businesses are small or medium-sized, employing fewer than 250. 95% are micro-businesses, employing fewer than 10. Whenever you hear of job losses, is it from an SME? No, it's a national retailer or an international car or steel manufacturer has just announced the closure of this plant in wherever with a loss of 1,000 jobs. Or it's Ford, taking £80 million from the EU and sending the jobs to non-EU Turkey. You couldn't make it up. If I was Ford, I would do exactly that. If it's like Google and the £130 million tax they just paid. If I was Google, I would pay only as much tax as the law requires of me. Thank you, whomever wrote the tax laws, Gordon Brown and George Osborne. As a business leader, it would not be for me to pay more tax or locate a manufacturing plant in the most expensive location. No, I would take whatever handouts I can lobby from the politicians and bureaucrats. The politicians and bureaucrats who set the tax laws and make large handouts. It's not the politicians' money. It's mine and yours. The difference is, before the EU, our government would make the handouts. That worked well into the 1970s, didn't it? Now it's on a continental scale, and the unelected bureaucrats are making handouts to even bigger companies. SMEs are falling behind in opportunities yet again. So to finish off, if you want to help A, the criminal big banks who, for example, fraudulently massaged Greek economic statistics to get them into the EU and were paid vast amounts for the service, then loaned vast sums to Portugal, Spain and Greece at the same interest rate that they loaned to Germany and the UK, and then were bailed out by you and me and our kids, and B, also help businesses relocate to China, India, Mexico, Turkey, etc., aka the wealth destructors, then vote Remain. On the other hand, if you want more free markets, more economic prosperity, lower living and business costs, and to give SMEs, the real wealth generators, a chance, vote Leave. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jonathan, for that positive case for SMEs outside the EU. Over to you, Ruth.
Thank you very much. Previous speakers, and obviously I totally agree with both of you just said. And because, particularly Rupert, you covered the cost so more than adequately, if not brilliantly, then actually I don't actually just say anything more about them. And I've been given permission to just generally talk about where I see the campaign going and what the UK may look like in a post-Brexit situation, hoping, praying that actually on the 23rd of June, the good people of Britain do vote to leave. I know one person we're voting to leave. Well, that's you. Well, actually, I know several. But you can count me in, so to speak, else I wouldn't be here. But it does strike me as the campaign goes on, and we saw yet more fear factor, Project Fear this morning from both France and indeed from BMW, SNMT, my goodness me, they're all piling in. My only hope is they sort of run out of steam by April, which they could well do. I suspect the British people are getting a little bit fed up with it, but there we go. But it does strike me that we do have to think quite hard about the campaign and what are the important things in it. And for me, there are two main issues. One, of course, is about controlling our laws and controlling our borders. And in a way, I suspect that all the various other groups are managing to run with that particular theme more than adequately. And I suspect the British people are there with us. But the other one, of course, is the economy. It is not just what you were saying, John, but more generally, the Project Fear, you know, oh my goodness, 3 million jobs, you know, the nick-click sort of thing. Well, by the way, 3 million was more than the votes that the Lib Dems got at the last general. I looked it up on Wikipedia, and they got 2.4. Perhaps they're only Lib Dems who lose their jobs. Actually, I think they did. And I must go back to my speech. But it is going to be the economy. It's going to be a matter of reassuring people that they, in other words, the European Union, will still trade with us if we leave the United Kingdom, and those jobs associated with that trade will not actually disappear into thin air. And it was interesting that there was a survey by ComRes in the Daily Mail after the Great Deal. Remember the Great Deal? Well, I don't. Rumour has it the Prime Minister negotiated this deal on the 19th of February, but never mind. And they asked four questions as to whether you thought, you know, this particular issue would be better dealt with in the EU or out of the EU. And the first one was on immigration, and it was quite clear that people strongly felt that we'd be better off out of the EU in order to control immigration. So in a way, controlling the borders and migration, this one's in the bag. The second one was on the strength of British democracy. Well, again, believe it or believe it not, the great British people thought that it would be better out than in, which I'm delighted to realise. On the third one was security. Well, it was a bit iffy, but on the whole, the people thought it was perhaps a little bit better to stay in than actually leave, but it wasn't that obvious. But the fourth one was about the economy, and this really was quite a wake-up call, I think, because it's clear that a good majority of people who are asked about that thought they were better to be in rather than out, because in a way they bought this narrative about the economic suffering, the economy suffering if we left the EU. This is in a way our Achilles heel, and this is what I think we have to offer so much reassurance about. Reassurance, reassurance, reassurance. And this brings me to this rather vexed question of what our trading relationship would be if Brexit. And I did hear the Foreign Secretary on the Today programme yesterday, which got me up pretty sharpish, I must say that. But much ink has been spilt on whether we go for the Norwegian option or the Swiss option, or whether we go for the Canadian option or the Turkish option, or Flexit, or whatever you want to call it. To me, this is all a distraction, because at the end of the day, we will have a trading relationship with the EU that our government negotiates. And given the fact there is a possibility, and I would like to think it is a strong possibility, if not a probability, that the great British people will vote to get out on the 23rd of June, I would hope that our government is already making contingency plans. Really, I'm quite serious about this, making contingency plans for if there is an out vote. Because the Prime Minister has said that he will trigger Article 50, the withdrawal clause in the Lisbon Treaty, straight away. So there'll be no time to just sit on our hands through summer. And actually, the Foreign Office, the Treasury, the Department for Business, and I was a civil servant for quite some years, more years than I care to remember. Well, it's so long ago, I've probably forgotten it, but there we go. But those departments will have to get their heads down and seriously start negotiating a new relationship. And I'm afraid it did cause a slight smile, I brought a slight smile to my lips when, if I may say so, the Foreign Secretary was criticising us Brexiteers for not knowing the exact details of what that trading relationship should be. Because I said to myself, if not shouted at the radio, actually, you're the one who'll be doing the negotiations. If you don't know, how do you expect me to know? Because, sorry, the responsibility will be with the government to do the negotiations. We cannot know what those final outcome will be. We've got a very fair idea as to what it might look like, but when Brexiteers are tackled about the exact relationship they will have when we leave, we do not know what will be negotiated. End of story. And I seriously would like to think that these contingency plans are being thought through. Not that I expect the government to share their thoughts or speculations or ideas or ambitions with us before the 23rd of June. Oh, no. But there we go. If the negotiations, then the government starts its negotiations, I would sincerely expect them to do the best deal for Britain. Now, having said that, we do have a reasonable framework we can discuss quite sensibly, and that is that when we leave the EU, we will still be trading under the World Trade Organization rules. As I said on many other occasions, the idea that we'll be locked out of trade and bobbing around in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean is absolutely untrue. And let's be honest, still a very sizable minority of global trade is actually trading under the WTO rules without any preferential trade agreements. A good deal of it. And let's just be frank about this. Look at Anglo-Chinese trade over the last decade. It has increased several times Anglo-EU trade over the last decade. Excuse me, is China in the EU? Well, if it is, nobody will tell me. In other words, trade flourishes where the commercial situation is right. It doesn't necessarily flourish because you're in a customs union called the EU. And indeed, as we know, because we've discussed this again many, many times, that the EU is now a relative declining part of the world economy. It is a stagnant, mature market. And whereas the growth markets for any business, no doubt if you were dealing with overseas clients, you'd probably be looking beyond Europe, the growth markets are outside the EU. And in fact, the demographics, if you ever look at the demographics of a country like Germany, you realize that this rate of decline can only go through to the 2020s, the 2030s, the 2040s, when frankly I don't care anymore, but there you go. Now, with the WTO rules, of course, we would still be facing the common external tariff of the EU, which, according to the House of Commons library paper, weighted average is about 1%, which doesn't sound very great when you think about it, although we know there are certain things like automotive vehicles, in other words, cars, that have a common external tariff of about 9.5%. And when people talk about 50% common external tariffs, I think that's what things like caviar. I really don't know, but that is just exaggerated. But cars, and I think chemicals too, businesses, products like that would be facing not a non-trivial, I think it's true to say that 9.5% is non-trivial tariff. So at that point, I would expect the British government to sit down with our EU partners and negotiate some sort of trade agreement. obviously to get rid of the tariffs, in other words, to have a free trade agreement, but also why not include some of the services, not least of all financial services, that are so important to this country. They should lay their cards on the table. They should be ambitious about what sort of trade agreement they want. And let's be honest, the EU, I don't know if any of you looked at the Canadian Comprehensive Economic and Trade Agreement recently, but it's a fairly ambitious document. They're looking at non-tariff barriers, they're looking at some services as well as trade, and they've abolished nearly all the tariffs. And if the EU can do that for Canada, which I'm delighted that it has done, then there's no reason why the British government shouldn't at least pitch its ambitions at that level, and indeed some more. I mean, come on. And of course we know that the EU would be, I think, more than delighted to have a trade agreement with us. I know it's said 100 times, but it is worth repeating that we do have the most ginormous trade deficit with the EU, and money talks. But did you say that? Or did he say that?
Well, the old adage, money talks.
Money talks. You can see him sitting there in my purse going, yap, 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 yap. Much than my cats. But I don't discuss my cats today. I had to leave them to come and talk to you. And as I shut the door behind me, their little whiskers began to twink. Never mind, he's probably got to sleep now. They might wait for me to get home, but there you go. However, there is no doubt we have a very, very big trade deficit. Last year, there was a goods deficit, 2015, that's last year, by the way, of 150 billion sterling. 89 billion was with the EU, 31.6 billion was with Germany. I think you can tell I was a government statistician for a long time. I love facts and figures, and they're all sourced, it's just like Ripper's paper. And under those circumstances, can you imagine any German exporter wishing to see any disruption to their trade, any diminution in their trade with this country? Would their government? I very much doubt it. I don't think the German government would want any problems. And so this notion that these talks would drag on until 2030 or 2025, if you're lucky, I think that is just scaremongering. It would be in nobody's interests, not least of all the EU's, for these talks to drag on. They would want to make an agreement pretty quickly, preferably within the 2-year negotiating window. No, they wouldn't want a disruption. So I think all this business about uncertainty going on forever and ever and ever, I just think it's not realistic at all. And under this sort of deal, so you'd have WTO and then you'd have a trade agreement. In other words, what David Campbell Bannerman calls WTO Plus, which I think is a very nice way of putting it. There would be no free movement of the people because that would be not part of the trade agreement as far as I'm concerned. We would not blindly have to follow EU's regulations, though of course we'd follow the product standards, but we do already. That's not a big deal. And when you trade with the United States of America, you follow their product standards. This isn't, it's not rocket science. If you export, you actually have to comply with the country you're exporting to. It's common. In fact, it's universal. So what can one say? And thirdly, we would not contribute to the EU budget. This is an utter mess. If you leave the EU, you do not contribute to the EU budget. But like Norway and Switzerland, you could volunteer to actually contribute to some of the EU's policies and projects and initiatives. Fine. All right, it's all true. So with the figures that you, when you were talking, Rupert, about saving on the contributions, perfectly valid point. Perfectly valid point. That's why I wouldn't be here. So there we are. I think under those circumstances, I suspect the initial impact of Brexit on the economy would be pretty minimal. And I was pleased to see a paper out recently by Woodford Investment Management, which you probably know, that basically came to that conclusion as well. And further out, and again, Woodford paper made this point, that in fact, because certainly you're free of the regulations, or at least you could amend or repeal some of the regulations, you'd certainly save on the budget. You'd be able to negotiate any trade agreements, which we can't do now because we're in a customs union. And believe me, the EU's little collection of trade agreements are not that spectacular. I do recommend that you look at them and you'll say, well, what's the big fuss about? And ironically, EFTA, which has got 13 million people, has got a better collection of trade agreements than the EU has. And it gets through them much quicker than the EU because, of course, there are four relatively small countries and they sit down and they decide what to do and they get on with it and they negotiate it. And you don't have all this horse trading that you find in the EU 28. And last but not least, of course, so that's regulations, that's trade agreements, it's contributions, and of course, you would be able to have a non-discriminatory immigration policy, which I think would be a real asset to business, because how many times do you hear business say, well, you know, you can have any EU national, but when it comes to a non-EU national, that actually can be quite a big problem getting visas from. Why? Why the discrimination? So I think the short-term impact would actually be painful. And then further out, and I know time is of the essence, Rory, I would hope that the British government, even now, in the corridors of power, in the Treasury, in the Foreign Office, or wherever, are thinking about other arrangements. Not just WTO plus a trade agreement with the EU, but also trade agreements with the countries that actually the EU already has trade deals with. I said they weren't very spectacular, but to continue the trade agreement with Korea, for example, would be useful. And when the Canadian one comes on stream, that would be useful as well. But then you could, the government could take the current trade agreements that are being negotiated and really use them as a template. I don't see why these negotiations go on for decades. I think this is bizarre. And of course, as I say, we could have trade agreements with China, Japan, United States of America, Australia, India, New Zealand, all those countries that at the moment do not have trade agreements. I hear what you say about TTIP. And finally, I think the British government should think about very hard about rejoining EFTA. Because by doing that, you would join a trade agreement with Switzerland and Norway, which actually are quite major trading partners of ours, not least of all because they're extremely rich. It's nothing to do with being outside the EU, of course, it's just fortuitous. Nevertheless, they are big trading partners. And in addition, if we rejoined EFTA, then we would have access to their collection of trade agreements that I've already said are actually more impressive than the EU's. Of course, you'd have to get the agreement of the third countries, but I would be very surprised if that agreement wasn't forthcoming. Now, last but not least, and then I will finish, I do think there are certain trading relationships that the British government should avoid. The first one actually is the Norwegian option. In other words, rejoining or reapplying to join the European Economic Area. By the way, if we left the EU, we would leave the EEA. Sometimes people think that, oh, well, if we leave the EU, we'll still be part of the EEA. No, I'm sorry. Well, I'm not sorry, actually. I'm not delighted. We would leave the EEA. There's this notion that somehow it would be awfully nice to be in the EEA because we'd have full access to the single market. Well, beware the single market, like beware the Ides of March, because the single market is, of course, the four freedoms of goods and services, capital and labour. Well, goods, thank you very much, a trade agreement, with looking at some of the long-term barriers as well, would do that. Services, well, the single market and services barely exists. Freedom of movement of capital, what's the problem? It's a global matter. Freedom of movement of persons, I don't actually think we want that because I do think any British government after Brexit, when negotiations start, would be looking to control the borders. I cannot envisage them going into a relationship where they wouldn't be able to do that. So EEA, I suggest, cross it off the list. Turkish option, staying in the customs union, that's not a very bright idea. We wouldn't be able to negotiate our own trade agreements. And the Swiss option is an interesting one because because, of course, the Switzerland is not in the EEA, but it does have a whole series of bilaterals with the EU, in which we almost certainly would not replicate. One of the bilaterals, of course, is the free movement of persons, and I really can't see, again, any British government wanting to agree to that. But this notion, and I'm afraid I've heard it far too often in recent weeks, that if we left, we'd be like Norway or Switzerland, and we'd still have to take the regulation, we still have free movement of persons, that is just not true. We wouldn't have to be in that situation at all. It would be a decision of the British government as to whether we go down that route or not. And I bet your, my bottom dollar that they wouldn't go down that particular route. So, all in all, I'm very optimistic about this country generally, but I'd be more optimistic if we left the EU.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you very much, Ruth, and thank you very much to all our speakers. We've heard about the savings we make through our contributions and the protectionist measures put on this country through the Common Agricultural Policy and the Customs Union. We've heard about how SMEs and small medium-sized enterprises will be able to flourish outside the EU and save their cash on the regulations that are imposed by the unelected bureaucracy of the European Union. And we've also heard about the trading relationships and the positive message that we can go into the relationships of the trading negotiations after Brexit. And I would just like to say something on that, where Philip Hammond, our esteemed Foreign Secretary, the other day said non-EU alternatives were too costly. The Swiss Parliament voted to end their EU application after 24 years, saying it was too costly an institution to be a member of. So on that note, I would like to open it up for debate and questions from the floor. We've got about 20 minutes from questions to our panelists and speakers. And if I may see some hands for questions. And there's a chap in the back corner there. If you could say your name and...
Councillor Richard Brode, Stoke-on-Trent. Obviously, I'll be back in the Brexit campaign. I'm organising my own campaign for the Stoke-on-Trent area. And one thing that I'll be doing is framing everything around the Article 50 clause of 2 years for renegotiations. So it should just put all scare tactics to bed, because things aren't going to change straight away, so there's time to negotiate.
Right. Yeah, and does any panelist want to mention Article 50? Or no, but that's great in the sense of it's reassurance in a way, isn't it? It's the point of reassuring the British population. And that's the key point, reassuring of the positivities, effectively, of what Britain can achieve, as well as the process going forward as what they can achieve with the negotiations with our EU partners. Are there any other questions? Okay, lots are being said. So if I could ask, if I take them all at once, in a way, the four at once, if you could keep your hands up. There's a gentleman there, the two gentlemen there, and then the lady at the back, if you could go in tandem and say what your questions are and who they are to.
My name is David Roach, and I think it's just been said, the Cameron's terms have been forgotten already. This is now going to be very nasty. It's going to be a war by other means. In fact, it's going to be a civil war by other means. Families will be divided on this issue. It's a bit like the first American Civil War, which they can now call the War of Independence. It was a civil war. And you will be divided, in this, we will be divided in this country too, between the patriots and the collaborators, all work. And the weapon of choice of the European Union, which I've seen many times in Eastern Europe with ministers going through their chapters, is very frightening. It's not the tank, it's bribery, bullying, and the box. And don't think we're not going to see it now. Mr. Cameron is dishing out peerages, he's frightening as best we can, and we've had to put it in the box. We have to fight by the same rules. I will give you later. I think we've got 5 million votes in there.
Well, and two gentlemen at the front with questions.
Could the panel say something about the effect on Britain's finances of the Eastern European, particularly people coming here and sending their money home, and the fact that most of the British people that work in Europe, sorry, that live in Europe, are the European Union, are actually pensioners who get their money from here and spend it over there.
Gentlemen.
As it's already been touched on, immigration, migrant problem, I had a letter used as an opinion piece in the Western Daily Press, which sets out quite plainly why Merkel and the European Commission are responsible for every person that's drowned in the Mediterranean in the past 8 months, absolute minimum. We then learn that 3 billion euros has been given to Turkey to try and sort it out. Nothing has happened. There's no oversight as to where that money goes, what it's used on at all. Yesterday, they tip up another 800,000 euros for exactly the same thing. They haven't got a clue. We should be pressing them. We should be showing how the EU is utterly useless in what is relatively a simple, though the Canadians have done it, a relatively simple problem. Early mornings, 5 o'clock, farming today. In the past week, I've heard that steaks come from Australia, they're sent to Hereford, they're trimmed, and they are then legally designated as Hereford steaks. I don't understand how that can be if we're supposedly free trading and we're supposed to get what we know what we're getting. And also, there was a tariff on lamb, someone mentioned. The last program I heard on the on Farming Today said that British retailers would prefer the New Zealand lamb rather than that which is produced in this country. Therefore, it can't be a price that's scaring them off. How can this possibly be? If we've got a CAP that's giving out money left, right and centre, surely it should be coming to our farmers to beat off the challenge of the New Zealand farmers. How does that work?
Thank you for that question. The lady at the back.
Yeah. Jackie Perkins from Canterbury. This question none of you has actually touched on, and every time I ask an MP or an MEP for their views, I'm told we don't agree with it and we vote against. Well, the UK gets a big vote in Europe, doesn't it? My main worry is the European army, and they're talking about it, and could a European army be used against a member state? Just imagine if a member state like Austria wants to close its borders and we have a European army and the bureaucrats in Brussels say, oh no, you're not to close your borders, what would they do? Can you all imagine what would happen with foreign troops on our streets in this country? And that's the one question nobody will ever give me a straight answer to, and I very much like a straight answer. Well, my dad spent 6 years of his life fighting for this country, and I don't think he'd be very pleased with your answers.
Well, I think Ray Finch there was looking to answer. If I may ask the panellists though their views on the questions that they've been posed and stuff.
Well, I'll duck the economic ones and pass them to my colleagues who know more about that. But I'm going to start with that last one about the European army, if I may. You're quite right, they are talking about forming a European army. The European Union does want to have its own military arm so that it becomes, because they want the European Union to be a country, and part of being a country is to have its own military forces. The situation at the moment is that, of course, the European Union does not have its own military forces. However, the President of the European Commission is able to deploy military forces belonging to a member state for the purposes of the European Union with the permission of the authorities of the member state that those forces are coming from. Crucially, however, he does not need the permission of the member state to which the military forces are being deployed in. And so, although this has never been done, and I think that they won't do it because it would cause absolute mayhem, it is possible for the European Commission President to say, turn to Monsieur Hollande in France and say, please will you give me a division of your troops, we've got a problem in Austria, and Hollande would say, yes, here they are, and the Austrian government would not be able legally to object to that happening. Now, this is one of these absolutely great issues that we Eurosceptics raise and everyone poo-poos us. Because, of course, the Europhiles on this are absolutely right that Herr Juncker would never do that. Monsieur Hollande would never agree to it. Of course not. I mean, they are sensible, reasonable, but they would never do it. But we don't know who the president of the European Commission will be in 35 years' time. We don't know who the president of France will be in 35 years' time. So when you're drawing up these constitutional issues, you have to build in all the safeguards in case the individual person holding the office is a complete and utter swine. And the European Union is not doing that. They are just assuming that whoever holds these offices will continue to be jolly nice chaps who went to a jolly good university and jolly well behaved and everything's going to be lovely. That's not how you should write a constitution, it's not how you should write the rules. So I'll shut up now and let everyone else answer the economic stuff.
No, thank you.
So, I first of all want to add to a point that Ruth made about BMW being pro the EU this morning. I find it remarkable that in the idea of cross-border trade, people are suggesting we wouldn't be able to sell Minis to Germany. They're made by BMW. As a capitalist and libertarian, I absolutely believe in the free movement of capital and labour. So I have absolutely no issue in anyone who wants to come into Britain can come, and anyone who wants to leave Britain can leave. But of course that's for another country to allow that to happen. The issue I have is that when people come here, those who are coming are of course largely coming from East Europe, where there is abject penury, and then they come here and they get a minimum wage, they immediately get working tax credits. So, you know, again, as a free marketer, take away these socialist practices, how many of them would stay? And that is the point that I make with regards to labour coming here. These people are great people. They're doing exactly what I would do, what you would do. They're just trying to make their way. The issue, of course, is, as Ruth quite rightly says, is that we find it difficult to recruit doctors from India and so on. Whoever made it about influence in the EU, we have no influence in the EU. It's absolute arrogant nonsense. We have no influence. We have enormous influence in the Commonwealth, so wouldn't it be great if we could actually do deals with the Commonwealth?
Yeah.
And on the point of agriculture and cost of living, the point is made about trade with China and tariffs. The EU socialists and the common agricultural policy applies massive tariffs on African farmers. I mean, how often over the decades have we cried when we've seen starving children on the television and we cannot trade with these people because it's uneconomic for them to do so? So, get rid of the CAP, get rid of the tariffs for farming agricultural produce to come from Africa, our cost of living would fall and their standard of living would rise.
Ruth.
Well, I'm not sure I quite agree with the free movement of people, but never mind. I'm sort of a capitalist, but not quite as libertarian as perhaps you are, but there we go. You asked about the impact on advance payments, especially about funds going from this country to Eastern Europe. I have to admit, I don't know the figures off the top of my head, but I suspect that they would be fairly substantial, because obviously a lot of the Eastern Europeans here do remit quite a lot of their earnings back to Eastern Europe. Personally, I don't really worry about that too much. I think we've got bigger fish to fry, if I may say so. But it's a fact. On New Zealand, Could I actually go back to the 1970s, which some of us remember very well? We had Commonwealth preference in those days, and of course we imported all this New Zealand produce that people enjoyed, not least of all lamb and butter. And when we joined the EEC, of course that all went, and New Zealand went into recession. At the time, I must admit, and I was a civil servant, believe it or not, I did actually support the notion that this country would join the EEC because we were such a basket case and we'd lost all our courage, and somehow we thought that this would be a sort of magic bullet that might help us. Of course, it did just the opposite. But I did think about New Zealand and Australia, where many of us have had relations. I thought that was an actual betrayal.
Yes.
I really, after it was only, I don't wish to sound like the sort of fuddy-duddy that Europhiles will laugh at, but I don't mind sounding like an old fuddy-duddy that Europhiles will laugh at. But it was only 30 years after the end of the war, and members of the war for my parents' generation were still very, very alive. And for my grandparents' generation, of course, still members of the First World War, when the Anzac troops fought so bravely. But that's a slight aside. I think the other thing, just I would say about the army, that may or may not happen. Whoever, we don't know. But this, if I may say so, brings to another point that, and this is an argument we must be very strong about, that when the Reorifiers go on about, oh, it's going to be terribly uncertain, we won't know what's going to happen if we leave the EU. The response from all of us has to be, tell me where the EU will be in 5 or 10 years' time. Could you tell me in detail what's going to happen to the migration crisis? What's going to happen to the Eurozone crisis?
It won't exist.
If you can tell me that, I can tell you exactly what this country will be like after Brexit. In fact, I have more confidence about this country after Brexit than where the EU is.
That's true. We've only got 5 more minutes left, so if I could take 3 last questions, I'll ask the panellists to respond to one of them and then give their final thoughts. The gentleman with the beard, the gentleman at the back, and Mr. Fitch, did you want to say something?
If I can quickly, it's just about the EU army. I remember when Clegg in his debates against Nigel Farage said there was no chance whatsoever of an EU army. A few weeks later, I was in the corridor in Brussels, outside the lifts, and I saw a poster from Aldi, the Liberals group, and it says, more defence for less money, Aldi roadmap towards an integrated EU military. Speeches by Verhofstadt, well, we know what he's like, the Czech Minister of Defence, the Dutch Minister of Defence, former Finnish Minister of Defence. There we go. They lied then, they're lying now. They always will.
So they have a plan.
Yeah, there's a plan there.
There we are. Gentleman with a beard. And then gentleman back.
I'll introduce myself. My name's Alan Taylor Shearer, and I'm a journalist for Radio Free UK, along with the gentleman behind me, Paul Perry. We do a lot of work and we broadcast 24/7. That's the advert done. Thank you very much. And I will be speaking to you all about that later. I did a piece just a few days ago talking about the EU military and the WikiLeaks releases of 3 documents which were partially written by an Italian general, which laid out the 3 phases of their extension of their powers. Phase 1 being coastal protection, phase 2 being beyond coastal protection, and phase 3 is actually on land in Libya. They intend to extend their powers to North Africa and to actually put themselves on land as EU police and military. As I said, that was partially written by an Italian general who was promoting all that. It's available on my blog, on our website. I've downloaded all the WikiLeaks documents. They're there for you to read. The EU military is a real thing. I'm a former Royal Air Force police officer working in security, so I was looking at that particularly. But myself and Paul do work every single day which is of benefit to you because we use your material. And we're broadcasting now, 24/7, the message to leave the EU.
Thank you very much.
Hello, I'm Robert Allen Haven, and I'm down from the Peak District today. When I talk to people about the whole issue, I find I'm drawn to people, obviously, who have not yet made up their minds. And I totally accept and respect people who are now taking a position. That's fine. No, but I really like talking to people who still say, and we know it so well, Robert, I'm confused. I haven't made up my mind yet. Now, those are the people that spark me off. Now, what I find the confusion is, it's a very natural thing for both sides of the argument to actually speculate. They're talking about the future, and Ruth, you raised it a moment ago. So many things, the truth is, we don't know how it's going to be. And that's true of all of us.
Yes.
No exceptions. And what I keep coming to is, all the time we look at the future, either side could be right or partially right, let's say. But it doesn't help the people who are confused. So I find what I'm doing when I have these discussions is actually say, hang on a minute, you may well be right when you've heard these arguments about what might be and what will be, but let's stick to present time. What do we know about the way the European Union functions, has functioned for years, and what it does every damn day? In other words, I want to bring the argument, the discussion, whatever, to the people who don't know. I want us all more to bring it into present time, because there's so much about the EU as it is right now and our position in it which is nothing short of disastrous.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, if I could ask the panelists to give their opinions on those three points, and well, that was very quick, and maybe a summing up of what we're doing and what we need to do going forward. But Ruth, if I start with you, then go around.
What we should be doing?
I think
that's absolutely right, that you can talk about EU as it is today, and with its plans, the plans we've heard from the theatre gentlemen. And there is an instinctive dislike about that. But I think surveys, I keep quoting surveys, I mean, if it's anything like, you know, the opinion polls, well, perhaps they're rubbish, but they do suggest that on the whole, the default position of British people is Eurosceptic. They really don't like the EU, but they're worried about the economy. And that's why I said the economics, trade, jobs, etc., that was nowhere our Achilles heel. And that's where, for me, that's where most work has to be done, on reassuring people that the impact in the short term will actually be fairly modest. You'll wake up and wonder what's happened, and in the longer term, it'll be better. I mean, that's my sort of focus.
Right, thank you, Ruth. Don?
There's absolutely no question that if we leave the EU, we will become a more prosperous and free society. I was going to say something and I've just suddenly got a blockage, just give me a second. Yes, on the subject of what do we need to do. I've attended anti-EU meetings and it's been obviously a much smaller scale. It was like Neil Kinnock in what was it, 1992, in Sheffield, we won, and it's been very much, we're going to win this. Well, the polls suggest it's very evenly balanced, and the bookies are very much on the Remain side. So we are absolutely not, certainly, going to win this. Gentlemen at the back, couldn't agree with you more. It's the don't knows who will decide this, because according to the polls, it's fairly balanced between the Remains and the Leaves. The don't knows amount to about 15-25% of the population. They need to be brought into our side, because they are the ones who are going to decide this referendum.
And it's not going to happen by people like us who already largely agree, certainly agree on leave or remain, talking to each other. It's going to take national campaigners, people like Farage and Hoey and Bannerman and Gove and Johnson, talking on the national TV and radio and press stage. But on top of that, it requires local communities. You know, they're having the Clean for the Queen just now, which you might have heard of. It requires local communities to get out and put these through letterboxes, time and time again. That's the only way this is going to happen, and we've got one chance. And once it's done, if we fail, that's it, game over.
Rupert. Thank you. Yes, my business is the campaign, so I've already done my pitch about getting you to use our materials, but also go producing good materials, both Levi as well. I'm just going to pick up a point the final gentleman made there. This is actually about getting votes in to the ballot box. Convincing people we're right is important, but it is in fact only a means to an end. The end is getting the votes into the ballot box. So I would say to you that if you meet somebody who is uncertain which way to vote, by all means, talk to them, give them our materials, point them in the right direction to find more information. If you find somebody who is definitely going to vote Leave, you need to tell them that it is a very tight race, that things are very close, and they absolutely must go and vote on the 23rd of June. If there's any chance they might be away on holiday, on business, or visiting a sick relative, please, please, please get a postal vote. Because it doesn't matter what they intend to do, what only matters is what they do, and that means getting a vote in the ballot box. And finally, if you meet someone who tells you that they have decided to vote to stay in the European Union, you say to them, oh, quite right, you know what, your lot are probably going to win anyway, because with a bit of luck, you won't bother going to vote.
And on that note, there's a gentleman.
Michael Gerron from Tunbridge and Morning. I would like through you to ask what Better Off Out is doing to dovetail with all the other groups. I'm a member of Go and Leave.uk and two or three others, and I got a feeling that we do need to present an arrowhead here rather than lots of little darts around. The Remain people have got the advantage of us as the volume of wealth and the incumbent government who are being totally unfair, as one would expect in that direction. Could you explain, please?
I'll deal with it very quickly. I hold regular meetings with people from other campaigns. We are all separate campaigns, and we attack things from different ways. I mean, stuff we do is really quite populist compared to some things that Vote Leave are doing, for instance, but that's fine. What we do is we don't coordinate our activity, because that would be improper under the referendum legislation. We tell each other what we're doing, and therefore making it. So, for instance, if Vote Leave say that they're having a street stall in Canterbury next weekend, I might conclude that it would be a wasted effort if we had a street stall in Canterbury, and therefore our people would be better off in Faversham. So we are cooperating, we do meet on a regular basis, but we are not the same campaign. And actually, I'm quite happy with that. We're in favour of free markets, we do populist stuff, Vote Leave does more intellectual stuff aimed at the press. The message is the same, it all gets out there. It's fine.
Yeah. And there's also an added, if I may add on to that, there's also an added point about doing different things, not just in different areas, but talking about the price of fish in the coastal regions when others are not. So we're picking up local campaigns and helping put information which the other groups aren't doing to complement rather than contradict or indeed compete. So on that note, on that positive note of coordination and complementation, if that's the word, then I would like to draw this meeting to a close by thanking our panellists and you for coming. And if you may thank our panellists for the wonderful words of wisdom they've managed to say in the usual way, that'd be wonderful.